Chapter 9.
It's the Countess Olenska, said Sir 5, and at half after the hour Newland Archer rang the bell of the peeling stucco house with a giant wisteria throttling its feeble cast iron balcony, which as he had hired, far down West 23rd Street, from the vagabond Medora. It was certainly a strange quarter to have settled in. Small dressmakers, bird stuffers and people who wrote, were her nearest neighbors, and further down the disheveled street Archer recognized a dilapidated wooden house, at the end of a paved path, in which a writer and journalist called Winsett, whom he used to come across now and then, had mentioned that he lived. Winsett did not invite people to his house, but he had once pointed it out to Archer in the course of a nocturnal stroll, and the latter had asked himself, with a little shiver, if the humanities were so meanly housed in other capitals. Madame Olenska's own dwelling was redeemed from the same appearance only by a little more paint about the window frames, and as Archer mustered its modest front he said to himself that the Polish Count must have robbed her of her fortune as well as of her illusions. The young man had spent an unsatisfactory day. He had lunched with the Wellands, hoping afterward to carry off May for a walk in the park. He wanted to have her to himself, to tell her how enchanting yes he had looked the night before, and how proud he was of her, and to press her to hasten their marriage. But Mrs. Welland had firmly reminded him that the round of family visits was not half over, and, when he hinted at advancing the date of the wedding, had raised reproachful eyebrows and sighed out. 12 dozen of everything hand-embroidered, packed in the family land they rolled from one tribal doorstep to another, and Archer, when the afternoon's round was over, parted from his betrothed with the feeling that he had been shown off like a wild animal cunningly trapped. He supposed that his readings in anthropology caused him to take such a coarse view of what was after all a simple and natural demonstration of family feeling, but when he remembered that the Wellands did not expect the wedding to take place till the following autumn, and pictured what his life would be till then, a dampness fell upon his spirit. "Tomorrow," Mrs. Welland called after him, "we'll do the Chiverses and the Dallases," and he perceived that she was going through their two families alphabetically, and that they were only in the first quarter of the alphabet. He had meant to tell May of the Countess Olenska's request, her command, rather that he should call on her that afternoon, but in the brief moments when they were alone he had had more pressing things to say. Besides, it struck him as a little absurd to allude to the matter. He knew that May most particularly wanted him to be kind to her cousin. Was it not that wish which had hastened the announcement of their engagement? It gave him an odd sensation to reflect that, but for the Countess's arrival, he might have been, if not still a free man, at least a man less irrevocably pledged. But May had willed it so, and he felt himself somehow relieved of further responsibility and therefore at liberty, if he chose, to call on her cousin without telling her. As he stood on Madame Olenska's threshold, curiosity was his uppermost feeling. He was puzzled by the tone in which she had summoned him. He concluded that she was less simple than she seemed. The door was opened by a swarthy foreign-looking maid, with a prominent bosom under a gay neckerchief, whom he vaguely fancied to be Sicilian. She welcomed him with all her white teeth, and answering his inquiries by a head shake of incomprehension led him through the narrow hall into a low firelit drawing-room. The room was empty, and she left him, for an appreciable time, to wonder whether he had gone to find her mistress, or whether he had not understood what he was there for, and thought it might be to wind the clock of which he perceived that the only visible specimen had stopped. He knew that the southern races communicated with each other in the language of pantomime, and was mortified to find her shrugs and smiles so unintelligible. At length she returned with a lamp, and Archer, having meanwhile put together a phrase out of Dan and Petrarch, evoked the answer, "La signora e fiori, ma vera subito," which he took to mean, "He's out but you will soon see." What he saw, meanwhile, with the help of the lamp, was the faded shadowy charm of a room unlike any room he had known. He knew that the Countess Olenska had brought some of her possessions with her, bits of wreckage, she called them, and these, he supposed, were represented by some small slender tables of dark wood, a delicate little Greek bronze on the chimney-piece, and a stretch of red damask nailed on the discolored wallpaper behind a couple of Italian-looking pictures in old frames. Newland Archer prided himself on his knowledge of Italian art. His boyhood had been saturated with Ruskin, and he had read all the latest books. John Addington Symonds, Vernon Lee's Aporian, the essays of P.G. Hamerton, and a wonderful new volume called The Renaissance by Walter Pater. He talked easily of Botticelli, and spoke of Fra Angelico with a faint condescension. But these pictures bewildered him, for they were like nothing that he was accustomed to look at and therefore able to see when he traveled in Italy. And perhaps, also, his powers of observation were impaired by the oddness of finding himself in this strange empty house, where apparently no one expected him. He was sorry that he had not told May Welland of Countess Olenska's request, and a little disturbed by the thought that his betrothed might come in to see her cousin. What would she think if she found him sitting there with the air of intimacy implied by waiting alone in the dusk at a lady's fireside? But since he had come, he meant to wait, and he sank into a chair and stretched his feet to the logs. It was odd to have summoned him in that way and then forgotten him, but Archer felt more curious than mortified. The atmosphere of the room was so different from any he had ever breathed that self-consciousness vanished in the sense of adventure. He had been before in drawing rooms hung with red damask, with pictures of the Italian school. What struck him was the way in which Medora Manson's shabby hired house, with its blighted background of pampas grass and Rogers statuettes, had, by a turn of the hand, and the skillful use of a few properties, been transformed into something intimate, foreign, subtly suggestive of old romantic scenes and sentiments. He tried to analyze the trick, to find a clue to it in the way the chairs and tables were grouped, in the fact that only two jacqueminate roses, of which nobody ever bought less than a dozen, had been placed in the slender vase at his elbow, and in the vague pervading perfume that was not what one put on handkerchiefs, but rather like the scent of some far-off bazaar, a smell made up of Turkish coffee and ambergris and dried roses. His mind wandered away to the question of what May's drawing room would look like. He knew that Mr. Welland, who was behaving very handsomely, already had his eye on a newly built house in East 39th Street. The neighborhood was thought remote, and the house was built in a ghastly greenish-yellow stone that the younger architects were beginning to employ as a protest against the brownstone, of which the uniform hue coated New York like a cold chocolate sauce. But the plumbing was perfect. Archer would have liked to travel, to put off the house in question. But, though the Wellands approved of an extended European honeymoon, perhaps even a winter in Egypt, they were firm as to the need of a house for the returning couple. The young man felt that his fate was sealed. For the rest of his life he would go up every evening between the cast iron railings of that greenish-yellow doorstep, and pass through a Pompeian vestibule into a hall with a wainscoting of varnished yellow wood. But beyond that his imagination could not travel. He knew the drawing room above had a bay window, but he could not fancy how May would deal with it. She submitted cheerfully to the purple satin and yellow tuftings of the Welland drawing room, to its shamble tables and gilt vitrines full of modern sacks. He saw no reason to suppose that she would want anything different in her own house, and his only comfort was to reflect that she would probably let him arrange his library as he pleased, which would be, of course, with sincere Eastlick furniture, and the plain new bookcases without glass doors. The round-bosomed maid came in, drew the curtains, pushed back a log, and said consolingly, "Vera, Vera." When as he had gone, Archer stood up and began to wander about. Should he wait any longer? His position was becoming rather foolish. Perhaps he had misunderstood Madame Olenska, perhaps as he had not invited him after all. Down the cobblestones of the quiet street came the ring of a stepper's hoofs. They stopped before the house, and he caught the opening of a carriage door. Parting the curtains, he looked out into the early dusk. A street dash lamp faced him, and in its light he saw Julius Beaufort's compact English brougham, drawn by a big roan, and the banker descending from it, and helping out Madame Olenska. Beaufort stood, hat in hand, saying something which his companion seemed to negative. Then they shook hands, and he jumped into his carriage, while she mounted the steps. When she entered the room she showed no surprise at seeing Archer there. Surprise seemed the emotion that she was least addicted to. "How do you like my funny house?" she asked. "Oh me, it's like heaven." As she spoke she untied her little velvet bonnet and tossing it away with her long cloak stood looking at him with meditative eyes. "You've arranged it delightfully," he rejoined, alive to the flatness of the words, but imprisoned in the conventional by his consuming desire to be simple and striking. "Oh, it's a poor little place. My relations despise it. But at any rate it's less gloomy than the Van der Luydens." The words gave him an electric shock, for few were the rebellious spirits who would have dared to call the stately home of the Van der Luydens gloomy. Those privileged to enter it shivered there, and spoke of it as handsome. But suddenly he was glad, that as he had given voice to the general shiver. "It's delicious what you've done here," he repeated. "I like the little house," she admitted. "But I suppose what I like, is the blessedness of its being here, in my own country and my own town, and then, of being alone in it." She spoke so low, that he hardly heard the last phrase, but in his awkwardness he took it up. "You like so much to be alone?" "Yes, as long as my friends keep me from feeling lonely." She sat down near the fire, said, "Astasia will bring the tea presently," and signed to him to return to his armchair, adding, "See, you've already chosen your corner." Leaning back, she folded her arms behind her head, and looked at the fire under drooping lids. "This is the hour I like best, don't you?" A proper sense of his dignity caused him to answer, "I was afraid you'd forgotten the hour. Beaufort must have been very engrossing." She looked amused. "Hi, have you waited long? Mr. Beaufort took me to see a number of houses since it seems I'm not to be allowed to stay in this one." She appeared to dismiss both Beaufort and himself from her mind, and went on. "I've never been in a city where there seems to be such a feeling against living in a courtier's eccentrics. What does it matter where one lives? I'm told this street is respectable. It's not fashionable." "Fashionable? Do you all think so much of that? Why not make one's own fashions? But I suppose I've lived too independently. At any rate, I want to do what you all do. I want to feel cared for and safe." He was touched, as he had been the evening before when she spoke of her need of guidance. "That's what your friends want you to feel. New York's an awfully safe place," he added with a flash of sarcasm. "Yes, isn't it? One feels that," she cried, missing the mockery. "Ain't here is like being taken on a holiday when one has been a good little girl and done all one's lessons." The analogy was well meant, but did not altogether please him. He did not mind being flippant about New York, but disliked to hear anyone else take the same tone. He wondered if she did not begin to see what a powerful engine it was, and how nearly it had crushed her. The level Mingott's dinner, patched up in extremis out of all sorts of social odds and ends, ought to have taught her the narrowness of her escape. But either she had been all along unaware of having skirted disaster, or else as he had lost sight of it in the triumph of the van. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.